fails to explain the settlements we see on various islands, from the Sea of Flores and the Gulf of Aden. For each viable settlement and subsequent cultural development, at least 40 to 50 Homo erectus men, women, and children would have had to have arrived almost simultaneously. But what kind of language did Erectus speak? What minimal form of communication would it have needed? The answer seems to be something like what I refer to as a G1 language. This is a language in which symbols, words or gestures, are ordered in a conventional way when spoken, such as subject-verb-object, as in John saw Mary. Although somewhat contradictorily, the interpretation of the symbols in this agreed-upon order can be very loose. Thus, Mary hit John might mean, in the first instance, that Mary hit John, but might have other meanings available according to the context, such as Mary was hit by John, or Mary bumped into John, and so on. The context in which the words are uttered, as well as what the speaker and hearer know about Mary and John, in conjunction with general cultural knowledge and the agreed-upon word order, will determine the interpretation intended. A G1 language is, nevertheless, a real language. It is not some proto-language, qualitatively different from a real language. Such a language can actually express everything needed by a particular culture and is expandable to fit additional needs if the culture becomes more complicated. Think again of examples like no shirt, no shoes, no service. This can mean quite a few things, but members of American culture, at least, interpret the phrase as an admonition from a business establishment, even though there is little in the words themselves that indicates such a thing. Culture serves as a filter on what the meaning is. Grammar is another partial filter. So, in this case, Mary hit John might mean that Mary hit or bumped into John, but it would be harder for it to mean that John bumped into Mary because of the word order imposed by the grammar, which acts as a weak filter on the possible meanings of the sentence. Whenever the grammatical filter is less fine-meshed, as in a G1 language, the role of culture in aiding the meaning becomes even greater, though it is always present in all languages. The archaeological evidence leads to the conclusion that Homo erectus possessed creative thought and culture. In other words, in spite of skepticism from some researchers, Erectus spoke, was creative, and organized its communities by principles of culture. The cultural evidence is otherwise inexplicable. Erectus were seafarers and manufacturers, not only of technologically interesting hand tools, from Lower Paleolithic Aldewan tools to Upper Paleolithic Mousterian tools, but also vessels able to cross large bodies of water. Erectus communities, such as the one Gesher Benot Yakov, developed cultural specialization of tasks, and Erectus controlled fire, as evidence from several Erectus sites suggests. Once again, though, Erectus's speech and language may have differed significantly from those of modern humans, yet Erectus languages, nevertheless, would have been full languages. So long as they possessed symbols, ordering of the symbols and meanings partially determined by those components in conjunction with context, they had language. And it seems clear, for various reasons, that they would not only have spoken their language, but also have used gestures as aids to communication. Neither gestural languages nor music nor controlled use of pitch, as in singing, would have come first, covered in Chapter 10. Simple, G1, languages emerged with grammar, which, accompanied by pitch modulation and gestures, produced the most effective communication system the world had ever seen. This is the minimum form of language possible. Erectus speech, however it sounded, is an important but secondary question. Homo sapiens, still bigger brains, longer experience with language, a more developed vocal apparatus, and so on, give us huge advantages. They mean that sapiens languages are more advanced in the sense of having larger vocabularies and probably more complex, hierarchical and/or recursive syntax. Nevertheless, the upshot is that there is no need to suppose that Erectus spoke a subhuman proto-language. A proto-language, by definition, is not a fully developed human language, but rather merely a good enough system for very rudimentary communication. But the kind of language that Erectus would have used would have been good enough not only for Erectus, but also for modern sapiens, depending on the needs of individual cultures, because a G1 language can communicate almost as well as a G3 language. Erectus traveled almost the entire world, though based on current evidence, never made it to America, Australia, or New Zealand. But they made it to many other places. Here is a brief summary of Erectus sites and time ranges. Middle East, Geshur Benot Yaakov, 790,000 years ago. Urk el-Akhmar, 1.95 million years ago. Obadiah, 1.4 million years ago. Bizat Ruhahma, 1.96 million years ago. Italy, Piro Nord, 1.6 million years ago. Turkey, Dursunlu, before 1 million years ago. Iran, Kashafrud, before 1 million years ago. Pakistan, Riwat, before 1 million years ago. Pabi Hills, before 1 million years ago. Georgia, before 1 million years ago. Spain, before 1 million years ago. Indonesia, around 1 million years ago. China, before 1 million years ago. It bears repeating that, in their daily life, Erectus communities had to care for children and strategize together. They needed to plan things like what to do today, where to hunt, or which men stay with the women and children, and which go to find food. They needed to share information about signs ahead, about evidence of animals in the vicinity, or how to care for their sick, even if that amounted to little more than feeding them. It is, of course, speculation to imagine how they did these things, or how well Erectus communities understood or planned what they were doing, how they cared for each other, or how they conducted their daily lives. But by using the examples of current hunter-gatherer populations, along with the intelligence that Erectus needed to have based on archaeological evidence, these suggestions are probably not too far off. Erectus communities also had to learn to evaluate others and deal with them. There would be cheaters and laggards on the journey, perhaps murderers. There would have been injured people. They would have desperately needed to work together. These pressures developed their intelligence and cultural connection more each day, along with their values and priorities. Erectus did not simply walk single file or run randomly around the world. They were organized. They were smart. They were a society of cultured humans. And they must have had language. And yet, what is language, after all? With all this discussion of the language of Homo species, it is time to examine the nature of human language in more detail. 4. Everyone speaks languages of signs. By semiosis, I mean an action or influence which is, or involves, a cooperation of three subjects, such as a sign, its object, and its interpretant. Charles Sanders Peirce, 1907. What is language? Is language indeed something that Homo erectus invented? It is worth restating the basic principle. Language arises from the convergence of human invention, history, physical and cognitive evolution. The inventions that would have moved humans towards the languages spoken today were first icons and then symbols. The archaeological evidence, in fact, supports the order predicted by the sign progression of C.S. Peirce. Indexes would have come first, followed by icons, and then symbols. We find indexes earlier than icons, and icons earlier than symbols in the prehistoric record. Moreover, indexes are used by perhaps all creatures, icons recognized by fewer creatures, and symbols used habitually only by humans. Although Peirce, in fact, believed that icons were simpler than indexes, he primarily had in mind the human elaborations to indexes, not, in my opinion, how the signs are found in nature per se. Newspaper headlines, store regulations, movie titles, and other unusual forms of modern language are occasionally reminders of how simple language can be. There are some famous examples of languages reminiscent of possible early languages in the movies. You, Jane, me, Tarzan. Eat, drink, man, woman. And in store signs, no shirt, no shoes, no service, no ticket, no wash. These examples can even be found on billboards. You drink, you drive, you go to jail. In spite of their grammatical simplicity, we understand these examples just fine. In fact, one can construct similar sentences in any language that will be intelligible to all native speakers of the language, as in these examples from Brazilian Portuguese. Olimpíadas, Rio. Crime, sujeira. Olympics, Rio. Crime, dirt. Você feio. Você bonito. You ugly. Me pretty. Se leanço. Se documento. Without handkerchief, without document. Such phrases are interesting because they prove that humans can interpret language even when it isn't structured grammatically. Homo erectus's language might have been no more complicated than these examples, though quite possibly it was more intricate. What all of these examples show, however, and what would have also held for the language of Homo erectus, as for all of the languages of Homo sapiens, is that language works fine when it is underdetermined. In understanding language or people or cultures, context is crucial. It is necessary to take a holistic perspective on interpretation. What was the organism, its connection to the environment, and the thing it invented like? These are the questions that flow from a holistic perspective on the invention and evolution of language. This idea is explored in detail by anthropologist Agustin Fuentes of the University of Notre Dame in Indiana. He makes a case for an extended evolutionary synthesis. What Fuentes means by this is that researchers should not talk about the evolution of individual traits of species, such as human language, but instead that they need to understand the evolution of entire creatures, their behaviors, physiology, and psychology, their niches, as well as their interaction with other species. Fuentes asserts that a full picture of human species engages the biological, the cultural, and the psychological simultaneously as part of this extended evolutionary synthesis-based understanding. At the same time, Fuentes claims that current models of what culture is and how it interacts with the human psyche and body are poorly developed, at least in the sense that there is no broad consensus on what culture is. But there do seem to be components of culture and ways that such culture interacts with us. Many of the very traits and properties of the environment that we want to explain as part of language evolution are poorly defined, lacking widespread agreement on their meaning among the majority of specialists. For a theory of language evolution, an understanding of the roles of society, culture, and their interaction with individual cognitive functions is vital. Yet there is little agreement as to what any of these things mean. Although our bodies are a bit better understood, there are vast spaces of disagreement even about our physical makeup. In order to better understand the factors of our environment that affect our evolution, it might help to start by defining the social environment, beginning with the elusive idea of culture. A theory of culture underlies an understanding of language evolution. In fact, there can be no adequate theory of language evolution without a sound theory of culture. One idea of culture, mine, is the following. Culture is an abstract network shaping and connecting social roles, hierarchically structured knowledge domains, and ranked values. Culture is dynamic, shifting, reinterpreted moment by moment. The roles, knowledge, and values of culture are only found in the bodies, the brain is part of the body, and behaviors of its members. Culture is abstract because it cannot be touched or seen or smelled. It is not directly observable. However, the products of culture, such as art, libraries, political roles, food, literature, science, religion, style, architecture, and tolerance or intolerance, are non-abstract, visible, and tangible. Culture, as a dynamic force, is found only in the individuals of a society. Members of any society share a culture when they agree on a range of values and the relative priority of all the values that they hold. Members of a culture, in turn, share knowledge and social roles. One observes values and knowledge applied, or examples of expectations from different social roles in action through individual members of the society. This is culture in action. Each modern human, as did every Homo erectus, learns their place in society, what is more or less important as members of that society, as well as the knowledge common to all members. And they teach these things by word and example to their offspring. All humans, past and present, learn these things, as do other creatures. Nowadays, a very different theory of the origin of language than what I am urging here is popular among some. This is the idea that language is a disembodied object along the lines of a mathematical formula. In this view, language is little more than a particular kind of grammar. If that kind of grammar, a hierarchical recursive grammar, is not found in a communication system, then that form of communication is not a language. Proponents of this idea also maintain that grammar popped into being some 50 to 65,000 years ago via a mutation. This suggestion, even though very widely accepted, has surprisingly little evidence in its favor, and turns out to be a poorer fit with the facts than the idea that language was invented, but subsequently changed gradually through all Homo species to fit different cultures. Though language is best understood as an invention, the mutation proposal is very influential. The theory comes from the work of Noam Chomsky, who began publishing in the late 50s and is, according to some, now the leading linguist in the world. But Chomsky's view that language is a recursive grammar, nothing more nor less, is a highly peculiar one. Already in 1972, a review in the New York Review of Books by American philosopher John Searle, noted how strange Chomsky's conception of language actually is. This view is unusual because we know that languages need not have intricate grammatical structures. Some might instead merely juxtapose words and simple phrases, allowing context to guide their interpretation, as in the examples that begin this chapter. The main problem with the idea that language is grammar boils down to a lack of appreciation for the source and role of meaning in language. The view here, to the contrary, is that grammar is helpful in languages, but that different levels of complexity are to be expected among the languages of the world, including the extinct languages of Homo erectus. Moreover, complexity can vary tremendously from language to language. In other words, language is not merely a synonym for grammar. It is a combination of meaning, form, gestures, and pitch. Grammar aids language. It is not itself language. Language, whatever its biological basis, is shaped by psychology, history, and culture. I try to show what this means in Figure 7, which can be found in the bonus PDF. In order to get down to the nuts and bolts of how language itself actually evolved, there are two alternative views of development that must be distinguished. These are uniformitarianism and catastrophism. Uniformitarianism is the idea that the way things work now is the way they worked in the past. That is, the forces that operate in the world today are the same forces that have shaped the world since it began. Uniformitarianism does not deny the possibility of cataclysmic or catastrophic events playing roles in history and evolution. After all, uniformitarian scientists accept that there was a great dinosaur extinction event around 65 million years ago when an asteroid crashed into the Yucatan. But it says that catastrophic change is not the main driver of evolutionary theory, and that catastrophes should not be proposed as explanations without very clear evidence. Catastrophism, on the other hand, appeals to major upheavals, such as Noah's flood or elevated rates of mutations, as frequent explanations for the origin and development of life on Earth. Niles Eldridge and Stephen Jay Gould proposed that a great deal of evolutionary change is brought about by sudden macroevolutionary jumps that they called saltations. Saltational models might be accurate for some examples of evolutionary change, but they always require additional evidence. Uniformitarianism, rather than catastrophism, is taken to be a foundational truth in most scientific disciplines. In physics, few question the assumption of uniformitarianism. Physical laws show no evidence of having changed during the universe's natural history, at least subsequent to the Big Bang. And in geology, Charles Lyell's 1833 work, Principles of Geology, is known in part for its advocacy of uniformitarianism in Earth history studies. By assuming uniformitarianism, a model of natural selection is expected to account for the transformation of ancient life forms into modern life forms via gradual, homeopathic, baby steps. In the case of language evolution, there are good reasons to reject catastrophism-based views such as Chomsky's. Reasons include its poor account of the genetics involved and its failure to account for the influence of culture on language emergence. Moreover, this catastrophism view fails to account for the fact that mutations for language are superfluous because language evolution can be explained without them. Invoking mutations without independent evidence is unhelpful. In fact, the idea of language as a mutation simply offers no insights at all that help to understand the evolution of language. That is to say, that language evolution can be explained without mutations, based instead on gradual, uniformitarianist assumptions, rendering superfluous proposals of language-specific genes or language-specific mutations. Of course, one is free to propose mutations or anything else in order to construct a theory, and mutations are indeed among the drivers of evolution. But the rule of thumb in proposing mutations in the evolutionary record must be that, in the absence of evidence, do not assume miracles. And the proposal of a mutation as a crucial link in human language evolution must come with a full story of what evolutionary forces were at work at the time of the mutation that led to the spread of the mutation. Otherwise, it is just invoking a miracle. Even if language ability were a mutation, it could only have produced an ability to learn language at a time when, ironically, there was no language. Apart from this lack of synchrony between need and mutation, someone proposing such a mutation must also explain what the survival advantage of a particular trait, such as language, was at the time of the mutation. And such an explanation must go beyond speculation to evidence. It could not merely be that language or grammar made thought clearer. That is in all likelihood correct, but it doesn't speak to how or when language or grammar came into being. Nor does it offer any details on how it spread, either genetically or culturally. Otherwise, bandying about the word mutation is unwarranted and speculative. This is the major weakness of the saltationist, or what one might refer to as the X-Men theory of language origin. Moreover, such a conjecture is unnecessary. Good old-fashioned Darwinian natural selection offers a more scientifically grounded story. The sudden emergence theory of language origin, echoed by paleontologist Ian Tattersall in several works, also depends heavily on arguments based on absence of evidence. In this case, imagine a picture of a hawk in the sky, accompanied by the caption, "There are hawks here." Barring photo-altering software, this picture is pretty good evidence for the caption's veracity. On the other hand, a picture of a clear sky with the caption, "There are no hawks near where I live," is much more problematic. The latter photo shows only an absence of evidence. It does not show solid evidence of the absence of hawks. It could be nothing more than a coincidence that the photograph failed to capture a hawk in a sky otherwise frequently populated by hawks. What is needed in such a case are more data, such as the lack of flora and fauna that hawks prefer, along with the proper climate to sustain hawks. And identical reasoning applies to the unwarranted claims that language originated as a mutation, or that Homo erectus lacked symbolic representations. If they were right, of course, and erectus lacked symbols, then it would make sense to deny language to erectus. But in fact, all that one is entitled to claim is that no one had noticed any evidence for such representations to date. But such evidence does exist in the record of the erectus cognitive explosion marked by their migration from Africa. Moreover, there are languages spoken in the world today whose grammars have aspects reminiscent of what Homo erectus languages might have been like, namely, symbols ordered according to cultural conventions. In this kind of case, symbols follow an order agreed upon by members of a particular society. For example, Americans and Britons refer to, say, red, white, and blue, rather than white, red, and blue, when discussing their national flags. Symbols and ordering can sometimes be vague and ambiguous, and therefore erectus would have needed the ability to use context and culture to interpret fully what others said. To elaborate the nature of the absence of evidence argument, consider again what is known today about Amazonian tongues, which are unquestionably full human languages. But what record would exist of these languages if all their speakers died out and archaeologists discovered their speakers' bones 500,000 years hence? Forgetting for now that linguists and anthropologists have published grammars, dictionaries, and other studies of Amazonian communication and culture, would these cultures and languages bequeath any material evidence that they were capable of language or symbolic reasoning thousands of years hence? Likely not. As stated earlier, they would leave even less than what is found for Neanderthalensis culture, aside from the few cultures that make ceramics, such as the famous Marajoara culture discovered on the Switzerland-sized delta at the mouth of the Amazon. It would be nearly impossible to find direct evidence that they had language, just as is the case for many ancient hunter-gatherer groups. We are also unable to prove that the Homo sapiens who originally left Africa, or Neanderthalensis, or Denisovans, or Erectus, had language, though it would be astounding if they did not, based on the cultural evidence. Therefore, one must be careful not to conclude that earlier hominins lacked language merely based on the absence of evidence of artwork or what are commonly recognized as symbols in the prehistoric record. In the absence of evidence, the simplest idea about language evolution is that language gradually appeared via natural, incremental processes, following the invention of symbols, which in turn were made possible by the gradual evolution of the human brain and culture. This means that the burden of proof is on those who propose a sudden mutation for language, not on those who analyze the evolution of language as a gradual, uniformitarian process, fitting in with the rest of what we know about human evolution. In recent years, several paleoanthropologists have inferred links between tool-making and language evolution. These researchers do not employ the absence of evidence argument. That said, these studies appear to be based on an unusual conception of language as largely grammar and words, failing to consider the overall role and origins of symbols from abstract culture. They examine the growing complexity of tool use and relate this to a purported increase in language complexity, based on the assumption that the syntax of modern languages will always include complex syntactic devices for combining symbols, such as hierarchy and recursion. In addition, these researchers discuss the absence of symbols among earlier Homo species, contrasting this with the widespread use of symbols among sapiens. Efforts to explain language based on the archaeological record are admirable. Unfortunately, they often borrow bad ideas from linguistics to make their case. The principal bad idea is that quotidian objects are not themselves symbolic. Tools are symbols when they are the product of a culture. If one finds tools in conjunction with evidence for shared values and knowledge in a society, there is no need to look any further than the tools themselves for symbols. Tools may not be symbols for chimps, but they would have been symbols for Erectus. Second, grammar does not require complex syntax, and therefore, neither does language. There are many groups today that have well-functioning, completely adequate languages, but lack the kind of complex syntax that paleoanthropologists sometimes assume in attempts to correlate complex tools with complex language. But such cultures also use complex tools, an unexpected state of affairs for theories proposing steady, parallel growth of complexity of language and tools. The understanding of natural language evolution must incorporate also the fact that language is a cultural tool for community building. More intricate syntactic structures of the kind found in many modern languages, such as subordinate clauses, complex noun phrases, word compounding, and others, are not crucial for language and are later additions made for cultural reasons. expression of thought, proposed by some as the raison d'etre of language, is also a secondary feature of language. The evidence on hand from contemporary languages and the evolutionary record count against this in favor of communication as the primary function of language. At the same time, there is no doubt that the uses of language for thinking and communication are dependent upon one another. Each enhances the other. If communication is the basic function of language, however, then human languages are not quite so unlike the communication of other creatures as some linguists, philosophers, and neuroscientists assume. Communication is, after all, pervasive in the animal kingdom. Humans are simply the best communicators, not the only ones. But exactly in this quality lies the distinctiveness of human languages. Alternative hypotheses should not, of course, be rejected out of hand, but only if the evidence is ultimately against them. The following quote is typical. Communication, a particular use of externalized language, cannot be the primary function of language, a defining property of the language faculty, suggesting that a traditional conception of language as an instrument of thought might be more appropriate. At a minimum, then, each language incorporates via its syntax computational procedures satisfying this basic property. We take the property of structure dependence of grammatical rules to be central. Why do many researchers, such as those responsible for this quote, claim that communication is not the primary function of language? This idea flies in the face of what most people would regard as intuitive. Of course, the fact that a scientific idea doesn't match common sense does not automatically make it wrong, since scientific judgment frequently differs from the average person's opinion. However, the reasoning here seems to be that humans are not all that good at communication. Take two well-known examples. Flying planes can be dangerous, and visiting relatives can be a nuisance. Both of these are ambiguous. The former example could mean planes in flight can be dangerous because one might land on you, or it could mean piloting a plane is occasionally risky. Likewise, for the latter example, which can mean relatives who come to visit are not always welcome, or something like, a visit to my grandparents can prove tiresome. For some, it follows that although ambiguity is found in communication, it is not found in thinking. Thus, language works less well for exchanging ideas and information. If that were true, it would then suggest that the principal purpose of language is to aid thinking, not communication. This, however, doesn't follow. First of all, there are studies from the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at MIT that explain why ambiguity is to be expected in a communication system. It is produced by the need to keep the amount that must be memorized low while maintaining efficient communication. Therefore, if one says, I want to, you know I mean to, T-W-O, and not to, T-O-O, or to, T-O, depending on the context. This clearly is an English-only example, but homophones seem to occur in all languages. Second, ambiguity and vagueness are rarely problems because context usually enables the hearer to pick out the meaning the speaker intended. If one says, he came into the room, the pronoun he is vague. One can only interpret he if one shares enough information with their interlocutors to know who this particular he refers to. Third, ambiguity in writing and speaking is not inherently problematic for language. Rather, ambiguity often is the result of bad planning. Thus, if someone began to cross a classroom and walked into student desks on the way to the door, the judgment would not be that this is evidence that walking is not for locomotion. Rather, one might conclude that walkers should watch where they are going. And the same goes for language. Most ambiguity, vagueness, and other shortcomings of speech can be avoided by planning and thinking before speaking or putting pen to paper. Planning for communication, like planning in most activities, is helpful. There are other problems with the idea that language is not for communication. Evolution never designs perfect systems. Rather, it builds jury-rigged devices piece by piece, using what it already has in place. Language, like everything else about natural life, is imperfect. Communication breaks down, but so does thinking. The assertion that one's thoughts are unambiguous to oneself is just that, an assertion. It needs to be tested. Another issue to note is that it is by no means clear that all people always, or even most of the time, think in language. Many people, such as biologist Franz Duval and author Temple Grandin, claim that they think in pictures, not in words. Experiments to check such purported patterns of thinking are called for. In the earlier quote on language and communication, the authors claim that communication is a particular use of externalized language. This makes it sound rare indeed. They believe that the only kind of language that can actually be studied is so-called internal language, or I language. An I language is just what the speaker knows in order to produce their spoken external, or E language. French, English, and Spanish are E languages, but their speakers' knowledge of what underlies languages are their I languages. Although there are some who claim that we can only study I languages, this is misleading. E languages can also be studied. In fact, thinking about this more carefully, the only way to infer anything about a speaker's internal languages is to examine the utterances of their E language. E languages are the gateway to I languages. Moreover, our inferences about the analysis of any sentence or set of sentences are always based upon a particular theory. The interactions observed from speakers are the essential source of evidence of what speakers know, regardless of how we test them. Of course, it is an obvious fact that a given label for an E language, say, English, is an abstraction. After all, what is English? British, Australians, Jamaicans, and Californians all speak it in one form or another, but which is or is closest to real English? How is real English pronounced? What are its grammatical rules? There is simply too much variation in English around the world for anyone to say definitively what English is. Moreover, the sentences, stories, and conversations that form the database for discussing English do not themselves exhaust the language. There are always data from the variety of English spoken somewhere in the world that have not yet been collected. It is in this sense, therefore, that English is an abstraction. At the same time, the utterances one hears or the sentences one reads are not abstractions. They are the very concrete, empirical sources of what speakers know, what cultures produce, and what people actually do. Asserting that one ignores what people actually say, their performance, as some call it, in order to understand their competence, what people know about their language as opposed to what they do, is like claiming that college exams show nothing because they only measure performance. the answers students give, not competence, what students really know. Exams, however, exist precisely because performance is the only way to gauge competence. Whether the competence one wants to understand is knowledge of how to engage in dialogue, how to tell stories, or how to produce individual sentences, one can only figure out what speakers know by what they do. No one ever directly studies what people know. To assert that they do is a common error in thinking. Rather, one infers knowledge through behavior. It should also be remembered that the quote a moment ago ignores the fossil record, which makes it clear not only that language, culture, and communication were part of the same cluster of socially evolved traits of human cognition, but also that there was a slow, semiotic progression fueled by natural selection. Moreover, seeing communication as the primary purpose of language facilitates the understanding of what is most interesting about language, its social applications. Thus, for many researchers in the study of language, grammar takes a back seat to things like conversational interactional patterns, discourse topic tracking, metaphor, the usage-based accounts of grammatical forms, and cultural effects on words and how they are put together. Pursuing these ideas, and based on everything discussed so far about the evolution of Homo species, three hypotheses for the origin of human language come to the fore. Each of these takes a different view on the relative importance of when grammar arose in the evolution of human languages. The first hypothesis is known as grammar came last. According to this idea, the most significant and first step in the evolution of language would be the development of symbols. Grammar is little more than an add-on. Language would have existed before grammar. In this idea, grammar required all the rest of language to exist before it could become operational. In other words, language first needed symbols, utterances, and conversations before it created a grammar to structure and thereby enhance our communication. The second idea, a very popular one, is that grammar came first. According to this proposal, evolution of language is primarily about the origin of computational properties of language, such as syntax. Without these properties, there is no language. Symbols, gestures, and other components of language may have been around in some form previously, but patterns emerged that brought all of them together for the first time as a language. By this idea, there is no language without a very peculiar kind of computation. But a simpler idea is available, namely that the ability to chunk words or symbols into ever larger units, phrases, sentences, stories, and conversations, is really the basis of all computation in language. This combinatoriality informs our interpretation of words. Without it, in fact, we cannot understand well the individual constituents of sentences. Think of a string of words such as, "If the girl is pretty, then he will run up to her," and compare this string to, "Run thee up pretty her, if then girl is will he too." Structure guides the interpretation of the words, and, over time, it more finely hones their meanings, bringing about nouns, verbs, prepositions, and modifiers. Some take this checking to mean that form is a very specific kind of recursive, hierarchical entity. By this view, language is more than what can be diagrammed along the lines shown in Figure 8 in the bonus PDF. This type of diagram is typically used by linguists to represent the constituent structures of sentences. Though it might appear complicated, it isn't really. The tree structure does indeed seem to be necessary in order to understand how modern speakers of English construct their sentences. In this example, the graph represents one sentence, Bill saw Irving, as a constituent of the larger sentence beginning, John said that. Likewise, the verb phrase, saw Irving, is part of the larger chunk, Bill saw Irving. Furthermore, psychologists, cognitive scientists, linguists, and others have demonstrated convincingly that such structures are not mere artifacts. They seem to reflect what native speakers of English know in some way about their language. The grammatical structures every native speaker knows are more complicated than any that they are taught in their composition classes. The third principal hypothesis falls between the first two. It is that grammar came later. Though symbols came first, the evolution of language required a synergy between grammar, symbols, and culture, each one affecting the other. In this view, structure, symbols, and culture are codependent, together producing meaning, gestures, word structures, and intonation to form each utterance of a language. The notion that the form of sentences followed the invention of symbols might be interpreted in various ways. To understand this idea better, it can be instructive to view it in the context of the other two hypotheses. Each of these possibilities accords a role to structure in language evolution. This is because linguistic form is of enormous importance in human communication and thinking. At the same time, claiming that the design of sentences is crucial for language raises questions. Perhaps the most important question is whether tree diagrams like Figure 8, found in the bonus PDF, are either necessary or sufficient for human language from an evolutionary perspective. Two proponents of the grammar came first hypothesis. Hierarchical structure is the most important aspect of human language. And again, many who adopt this hypothesis believe that language appeared suddenly, as recently as 50,000 years ago. According to them, not only did language not exist prior to Homo sapiens, but not even all Homo sapiens would have had language, since the species is more than 200,000 years old. A sudden mutation, say 50,000 years ago, would have not affected all sapiens, but only the descendants of the Prometheus that won the language gene mutation lottery. The idea that a mutation had an effect that ultimately left most of a species alive at the time at a disadvantage, or less fit, in Darwinian terms, is not unusual. DDT resistance mutations have occurred in some insects, leaving them and their offspring the ability to thrive in a DDT-rich environment, while their conspecifics die off. But anyone proposing such a hypothesis obligates themselves to explain the evolutionary implications of their idea. The grammar mutation, to be of relevance to the evolution of language, must have made its possessor and his or her family more fit than other sapiens, that is, more likely to survive. Or perhaps it was favored by sexual selection, with better talkers becoming more appealing to the opposite sex, and thus getting more sex and having more offspring. A third alternative is that a family with the language gene left the area and, via a population bottleneck, became the founder population for subsequent Homo sapiens, guaranteeing that all sapiens would have the mysterious language gene. This contrasts sharply with claims that language appeared very gradually over at least the past 3 million years, and that all humans today have, and probably all Homo species in the past had, language. Very importantly, hierarchical grammars, those whose structure requires tree diagrams, The kinds of grammars touted as crucial to language in many approaches to linguistic analysis and language evolution are simply byproducts of information processing tasks independent of grammar. Nobel Prize-winning scientist Herbert Simon wrote about this in the early 1960s in one of the most famous papers of the 20th century, The Architecture of Complexity. Simon wrote that, "The central theme that runs through my remarks is that complexity frequently takes the form of hierarchy, and that hierarchic systems have some common properties that are independent of their specific content. Hierarchy, I shall argue, is one of the central structural schemes that the architect of complexity uses." And also, "I have already given an example of one kind of hierarchy that is frequently encountered in the social sciences, a formal organization. Business firms, governments, universities all have a clearly visible parts-within-parts structure. But formal organizations are not the only, or even the most common, kind of social hierarchy. Almost all societies have elementary units called families, which may be grouped into villages or tribes, and these into larger groupings, and so on. If we make a chart of social interactions, of who talks to whom, the clusters of dense interaction in the chart will identify a rather well-defined hierarchic structure. The groupings in this structure may be defined operationally by some measure of frequency of interaction in this sociometric matrix." Hierarchy would have been useful to Homo species as a way of understanding and constructing social relationships, of organizing tasks and even structuring language. And we see such hierarchy in the organization of the Homo erectus settlement of Gesher Benot Yakov. But hierarchy is something that would only be needed in direct proportion to the growth of complexity in communication content. What is being talked about, as information flow grew faster and more complex. Information-rich communication, especially when coming at high rates of speed typical of human languages, will be aided, just as Simon predicted, by being structured in particular ways. For example, the first three utterances will in all probability be harder for the average hearer to understand than the second three. "The moon is made of green cheese," or so Peter says. "The moon is made of green cheese," or so Peter says John. "The moon is made of green cheese," or so Peter says John, says Mary, says Irving, says Ralph. Peter says that the moon is made of green cheese. John says that Peter says that the moon is made of green cheese. Ralph said that Irving said that Mary said that John said that the moon is made of green cheese. The reason is that the first set lacks recursion. Sentences are all independent, side by side. But the second set does have recursion, one sentence inside another. It is a fact that, because of the complexity of the multiple quotes, recursion helps us to process the sentences more effectively. Although such sentences sound a bit artificial out of context, they are observed in English. Certain languages, however, those that lack recursion, can only produce sentences like those in the first set. As demands from the complexity of the society, such as the hearer or speaker interacting with more and more people they do not know, increase, so do the demands on grammar, though each society and language pair must be studied individually. It is possible to have complex grammars in simple societies, or the other way around. An advocate for a mutation for language would have to explain why there are no well-established cortical specializations for language or speech, aside from reusing parts of the brain for a variety of tasks, as many have claimed. The growth of the prefrontal cortex, itself associated with tool-making and sequential actions, helped to prepare the brain for language by providing the cognitive firepower necessary for actions where procedures or improvised sequences are required. This is a form of exaptation, evolution's reuse of something that evolved for one task to perform another.